Good morning, members. My name is Thakazile Dambu, Cluster Manager, Office of the DG.
Good morning. My name is Julian Masilela. I'm the Chief Director of the
Good morning, Madam Chair and all the members present today. My name is Mickey Pediachi and I'm Deputy Director General of Health.
Good morning, all members. My name is Joe Hart. I'm Parliamentary Officer in the Office of the Minister of Health. Thank you.
Thank you,
What makes me happy is that when you talk of high level persons, you are talking of women next to you, and that makes us happy that gender is being recognized in this department. And we wish you educate other departments that you need that, and it's encouraging. Thank you very much. Without wasting any time, maybe some of our members will be coming as we continue. We won't be held to ransom because of that. I'll just take it back to the department to give us what they have brought to us. Thank you. I'm being cautioned about other people that are here. Usually this is our, if I've done something wrong, please tell me. I'm not used to this chair, but what I know is that mostly it's our staff members, not knowing that side, maybe it's our researchers or what. Let me allow them to introduce themselves. Thank you.
My name is Blessing Bala. I'm from the Parliamentary Monitoring Group. I was just here as observer.
You are welcome.
Together with the... Can you tell us who you are?
Good morning. I'm from the SABC. My name is Elaine Lillington.
Okay. Thank you. Our officials?
Good morning. My name is Tulisile Ganyaza Twalo, and I'm the content advisor for this committee. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Tabile Kete. I'm the researcher for this committee.
I hope everybody is known now. Okay. Now, next to me, yes.
Good morning. My name is Edima Tonsi. I'm standing in for Debo for today, but I'm the committee secretary for Portfolio Committee on Home Affairs.
Right. Now we have the green light to continue. Thank you, conferencing. Thank you. Continue. Apologies for
that. Thank you. Thank you very much, Chairperson, honorable members. Honorable members have asked us to comment briefly on the strategic plan of the Department of Health for 2009 to 2012, and also on the budget for 2009, 2010, because it will be debated in the House on the 7th, as we understand it. So we will try and do that, Honorable Chairperson. The presentation, although I'm not going to cover all those points, is structured in such a manner that we followed more or less the structure of the state plan so that it's easy for honorable members to follow. So we talk about the vision and mission and right up to the actual budget and some of the bits that we've made in relation to that. If I move to, I'll skip the next slide because it's an obvious vision and mission statement, except to say that our mandate is to pursue this mission and ensure sure that our people live healthily. So you will see that there is an emphasis on prevention of illness. So this is not a department of diseases, although many people try to make it a department of diseases. It's a department of health, and health is health. It's not of the unhealthy. Otherwise, we would say department of the unhealthy. Well, if I may expand a little on that, you know, the Minister of Health uses a very nice analogy, which I'm going to appropriate. He says, you see, the people who produce, who in Australia are supposed to produce wool, ensure that all the sheep are there and they grow very well. And when they produce wool, they've actually addressed their core business. The fact that there is martin in the process is just, by the way, the byproduct of their main issue, which is wool and such. And I think in the Department of Health, we want to ensure that our people are healthy. The fact that we also look after diseases should be, by the way, when they get unhealthy. At the moment, because of the burden of disease, with a kind of inversion of that, which is that we actually concentrate more on dealing with and combating disease rather than preventing it. And so we want to say the mission must be able to, we must reach that point where we'll actually be fulfilling our mission. And we'll talk about that later. Well, there's a series of legislative instruments that guide the Department of Health. Currently, we have about 51 pieces of legislation, which members will come to be familiar with in the process. We've just picked up one or two as an example, but there are almost 51 of them. And we are likely to add more and amend others, etc., etc., in the coming years. Now, with regard to the strategic plan, we just thought we should give a bit of background for honorable members so that they could actually understand where this comes from. The PFMA, which is the act that guides us in terms of strategic planning, requires accounting officers or heads of departments to prepare strategic plans for each MTEF period for the approval of the executing authority. Now, which means that we as a department prepare the strategic plans and then get an approval of those plans from the minister before tabling them in Parliament here. This time around, we say this because honorable members will understand that the government, the new government, is a month old, and the strat plans are related to a budget that was passed almost in February. And so we have had to actually try and balance the two, balance the new priorities that have come with the new government and the fact that you had already more or less passed a budget, which in fact will be finalized in the assembly on the 7th, on Tuesday, and then later in this parliament. Parliament is supposed to receive the plans of the department at least 10 days prior to the discussion of the departmental budget vote. That's the rule. So in fact, the committee, this committee, should actually be able to engage with this strategic plan and the budget 10 days, I suppose, in preparation for the debate. But of course, it's not often possible between the two houses, particularly for this house, to actually receive these from that other house 10 days before the prioritization. But that's what the law says. So for future purposes, you might want to see how that is actually fulfilled. And of course, there are 11 stipulations with which we have to comply in terms of regulations, and we are set here that we fully comply with those. So members would want to go to the PFMA regulations and find out what are the stipulations for that we have to comply with. Now, linked to the strategic plan is the publication of what is called the estimates of national expenditure. I would advise that the researchers and the committee secretaries assist members to get hold of this document before Tuesday, because it actually is the document that summarizes, one, the strategic objectives of the Department of Health. I think there's a chapter on health in that. It says these are the objectives for which the money is procured for, and then it gives the details of how much money is being given to each one of those activities. So for purposes of discussion and debate, the members may have that as another point of reference, the estimates of national expenditure. Now, just to, in terms of the next slide, let me perhaps even before going deeper, as we welcome Chair, another lady who is the Deputy Director General in the Department of Health, Dr. Chetty. She's just gone out, but she's, see, we can bring more. and the Honorable Mube would know why, but we shall leave those for another occasion. Let me hasten to say to Honorable Members that the Department of Health, or the vote that we are dealing with in terms of the budget, is a vote related to the National Department of Health. As you will know, Honorable Members, all provinces do their own appropriation, and therefore they pass their own budgets in relation to the priorities, both national and provincial. So what we're going to present here is the budget of the Department of Health, the National Department of Health. However, because the members have an interest in provincial matters, we also thought we would say one or two things about some of the provincial issues that are arising in terms of the budget. Nevertheless, the issue, the strat plan, therefore, will reflect our attempt to integrate what is largely national policy and norms and standards, as well as programs that are actually implemented provincially. And I'm going to say more about that once I get to that point. In terms of the National Health Act, you can go back one. In terms of the National Health Act, whereas the PFMA requires that the accounting officer, or in this case the Director General, prepare the strategic plan for the Department of Health, and in terms of the National Health Act 2003, an attempt has been expressed in that act to move beyond simply the National Strategic Plan of the Department of Health. And so, and therefore, the Act requires that the Director General prepares a strategic medium-term health and human resource plan annually for the exercise of powers and performance of the duties of the National Department. And then, linked to that, an integrated plan which will then integrate the national departments and provincial departments annually. So, again, in fulfillment of that legislation, as we'll see later, we are trying to ensure that we keep the singleness of the system so that the national priorities can be expressed in all provinces, and then provincial priorities are also expressed within that national framework. So the provincial departments also prepare their own strategic medium-term and human resource plans in terms of that act, which is complementing, therefore, it can't subtract from the PFMA, so it adds and complements the PFMA. Now, in terms of next slide, the slides that follow reflect
the national health system priorities as have been adopted by the government at the cabinet and the Khutla, and some of them have been expressed in the State of the Nation address by the president. Let us say that our process looking at this, as I said before, when we started developing our threat plan as required by the PFMA, it was for the passage of the budget in February, which was read by the then previous Minister of Finance. But of course, as I've said, we have had to rearrange and readapt because the mandating party went to the polls and said and promised certain things with regard to health, one of them being that health is going to be a priority among the five priorities that it actually expressed in that manifesto. And within that, that manifesto of the mandating party outlined certain priorities with regard to health. And those, of course, were translated by the mandating party into what is now known as the 10-point plan, which is then adopted by the governing party. And they are listed there, Chair. I'm not going to list them one by one at this stage because I'm going to treat them one by one in terms of the actual presentation. So I'm going to skip the next four slides and move to five because I'm going to deal with them one after the other. Now, in other words, our strategic plan focuses on these 10 points in trying to take the health system forward. And let me preface that by saying that it's clear from the experiences of the last, say, 14, 15 years, that the health system in South Africa should actually take a different posture. In other words, it needs to be revamped in a different direction, reorganized in particular ways, and refocused if we are to meet the objective or the mission that I talked about, which was the mission of ensuring that we prevent illness and then ensure that those that do get ill have access to quality health care. Now, that 10-point plan is both an attempt at accelerating in certain areas and an attempt at repositioning. If you like, I would like to use another analogy also of a very huge ship which is already at sea and this stormy weather. At the same time, it has to go forward and fight the storms. But at the same time, as it is going forward, it is going to an icicle and therefore has to turn. So trying to do both, you know, steer it forward and manage the waves, and at the same time try and redirect it, is what we are trying to do in the next 5 years as such, and it will be clearer to members as I talk about it. So the first thing that has been prioritized is this issue of strategic leadership accompanied by strategic partnership, if you like. You have to have people who are leading, but you also have to ensure that those that are leading are leading a very powerful partnership for better health. So that priority is the first priority in relation to this. And of course, these things are not in the order of their prioritization. They're just a 10-point plan, as I said. So within that, the first thing is to ensure that the health sector produces, as I alluded earlier on, an integrated annual health plan, starting with this financial year in preparation for the next financial year. This is a very critical point in terms of ensuring that the health system acts in sync and in harmony. Although the National Health Act has actually required this and we have produced at least one or two of these. But this time around, there's some robustness about it to ensure that that national plan reflects national priorities and that all provinces, together with national, work according to that plan, to a singleness of purpose. So in other words, there's an attempt to ensure that the system acts in sync and acts as a system as one. The second priority is to ensure that if you are to do that, you have to define the system very well. And therefore, some aspects of the National Health Act, which are trying to define that system further, have to be, in terms of its organization, have to be finalized. And such as, for example, the clarity in terms of primary health care, the district health system, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then, as part of that strategic leadership, ensure that when you understand what are the marching orders nationally and what kind of a system you're trying to organize, you put in place clear mechanisms for monitoring and evaluation of that system. So the MNE system is going to be very critical. And on the basis of that, ensure that you develop the leadership structures that are community-based, such as hospital boards and other health committees in the community. Of course, there should be synergy and complementarity between what we do in government, which is to strengthen those formal structures, and what honorable members do in their communities, strengthening their constituency structures, including other structures that are contributing to the partnership in health. So that's very critical. But to continue then in the next slide, I spoke about the relationship between leadership and partnership. And so it's important for us at the same time to convene the National Consultative Health Forum this year to ensure that all of us are building consensus on the program of action and what we call a social compact, which is the social agreement between all parties to say this is what we are all pursuing and these are our different roles in relation to that. So that's a priority this year and this financial year, to ensure that across the board all of us agree, first of all, that our health system has to be repositioned and agree on the priorities for repositioning the health system, and then defining what each of the partners' role is going to be in that. And then creating mechanisms for engagement with communities, in other words, not only ending with that consultative health forum, but ongoing mechanisms such as Izimbizo and other forms of engagement to ensure that there is constructive engagement between the citizens who are the recipients of the services that we are providing and the citizens who are actually the custodians of their own health and the system as such that is supporting that custodianship. Of course, the issues of monitoring and evaluation I've spoken about. Some instruments that we use, we will have to ensure that we do them this year. Honorable members will see that that thing says South African Demographic and Health Survey 2008. That's because it's actually conducted every 5 years, and the last one was June 2008. But actually, it will now become a 2009, it has been delayed, or 2010. So that 2008 was just reflective of the fact that it was due after 5 years. And of course, if we go beyond that, it will actually not be very useful for comparison purposes. So that's why we still need to have a cut-off point of 2008 so that there's a bit of a comparison in relation to the outcomes that we are looking at. So that chairperson is the first priority. And you can see We're focusing on leadership and ensuring that there's a very clear sense of how we're organizing the system. We're focusing on monitoring and evaluation of that system, and we're focusing on mobilizing partners, both in terms of the community level and in terms of the representative organizations in health, to ensure that we all have the same marching orders. The second priority is one which has actually created some excitement in the public arena, and that is the implementation of the National Health Insurance System. Now, one understands why this, in fact, has become a major issue of debate in South Africa. It's because, as I said, we are not only talking about making the system that is moving move forward better, but we are also trying to reposition it. And therefore, the implementation of the National Health Insurance System requires that the system as a whole is reorganized in particular ways to be able to meet the objective of the National Health Insurance. Now, in terms of our priority for this year, let me emphasize, Chairperson, that we are producing a comprehensive policy document, what you would like to call a draft white paper, which will propose a framework for an integrated national health insurance together with draft legislation to translate that policy into law. And we believe that we will be able to produce that before the end of this month, early August. That's so that we can have a formal public engagement on this matter. So in other words, again, following our legislation, current legislation in the country, we are supposed to publish whatever policy or legislation that we would like the public to be consulted on, to publish that and allow a reasonable period of up to 3 months for public comment. Now, that's at the level of the executive. So we will do so, required by law, and then the public will engage with us, will listen to representation, views, etc., etc. Then, on the basis of those views, the executive will decide on the final form that legislation will take, or the final way forward, and then submit the legislation to Parliament for processing. So we're looking at that taking us to at least the end of this financial year, March 2010. So the current debates that are taking place are debates based on various drafts of documents leaked and leaked or stolen or whatever you want to say, which are simply people discussing ideas outside. They are not the formal policy of the government at the moment. The formal policy of government is that one, that we are implementing a national health insurance system. That's the first formal policy at the moment. And we will then present the policy proposals on the implementation of that national health insurance, as I say, latest beginning of August. And then, and only then shall people engage with a genuine policy document that comes from this government. It doesn't mean that people cannot debate various forms of national health insurance and have various views on implementation and how this can be done, etc., etc. It's okay. It actually keeps the energy going. But I want to emphasize that this government has not produced a policy document for discussion. So anybody who says the government is actually secretly trying to push some agenda underground is actually mistaken. We never do such a thing. And now I'm declaring that we will finalize the process of consultation by March 2010. And we will fulfill the necessary legislative processes of ensuring that the public is engaged in this matter for at least a minimum of 3 months, because that is what the law requires. I thought I should actually explain that so that honorable members are clear about this matter. As I say, the other discussions, and we are prepared to answer questions on the content issues, but we should say that would be premature because there's no content formally adopted by government. And of course, there are drafts and engagements, just like we do with any other policy processes. In the meantime, we're looking at the institutional and organizational structures that are necessary both to prepare for the implementation of NHI, but also are just necessary for the system. For example, you'll see later on we'll talk about the establishment of the Office of Standards. That's a necessary instrument for ensuring that our institutions, facilities, meet certain standards. But of course it will be very, very critical for the NHI implementation. If we continue, the third priority is the improvement of the quality of services. Chair, this time now I'm going to move a bit faster. I just dwelt on the first two deliberately because they contextualize what is happening. But I've already said that the issue of the quality of services is very critical, and therefore the establishment of the Office of Standards Compliance. Let me say that this is already provided for in the National Health Act, and what we are looking at is whether we would need to amend that act or simply implement a well-capacitated Office of Standards Compliance. So we're working on that, and we will focus on the implementation. This is in terms of our quality improvement plan, on the improvement of quality of health services in 18 districts. Now, this is not just a figure that we came up with. We have analyzed all sorts of trends, on all sorts of health trends, and we've come to a conclusion that the worst performing districts in at least 3 or 4 of those health trends should be the ones we focus on for change, so that we can impact on the health outcomes. If you talk TB, if you talk HIV, if you talk immunization of children, if you talk a whole range of indicators, you'll find that these 18 districts feature in one way or the other in the red or the negative side, on the negative side. So I've identified our turnaround strategy as the strategy that should focus on these 18 districts. And so when the committee has some time for us to visit again, we would be very pleased to work with this committee on these 18 districts, because this is a provincial committee, so it would actually assist us to look at what we're doing in those 18 districts. Thirdly, we are looking at the development of national norms and clinical guidelines for use in health facilities across the country. Now, this issue doesn't mean that we do not have clinical guidelines. We have a whole range of them in various situations, and we also have national norms for a number of things. But what we're trying to ensure here is that we foreground this issue of clinical guidelines and ensure that they are implemented and find a way to monitor the implementation. The facilities, the numbers that are given here are for purposes of our performance, but we want to ensure that all facilities all facilities across the country implement and benchmark their performance in relation to these clinical guidelines, including the private sector. You can see this is also a positioning for the accreditation, if there is any, in relation to the National Health Insurance. Supporting 100 public facilities, this is a strategic implementation. You see that we, at the level of the districts, we're talking 18 districts. At the level of the facilities, we're talking in relation to clinical guidelines, we're talking all facilities, but benchmarking the performance in an initial set of facilities. And then at the level of quality improvement plans, we want to ensure that we improve the performance of certain facilities. The idea here is that we're going to take at least 10 facilities per province and see if we can push a turnaround strategy around those facilities. So there should be 90, but of course there is a 10th province, which is national. So to round off, we're also going to then look at the other 10. Remember that this is in addition to the 27 facilities that we have been working with, which we did an evaluation of in terms of our evaluation guidelines. So that would actually assist us in looking at quality. And finally, linked to the issue of clinical guidelines and linked to ensuring that people adhere to those, we're also implementing a national adverse event reporting and response system to improve patient safety. So critical in this effort is the patient at the center of service delivery, and particularly patient safety among the criteria for a quality service. Patient safety being number one. If we can ensure that those mothers who are giving birth in those hospitals don't die unnecessarily, then we would have actually achieved a lot. Now, still on quality of services, there's two other issues that I want to highlight. The issue of the establishment of the Ombuds Office. This is also in the National Health Act, and we want to ensure that this time around it's established, it's functional, it's working. And finally, we want to ensure that all our facilities at a primary health care level have some form of supervision or the other. At the moment, our supervision rates, I think, are said to be at about 67% or something. And in some districts they are high, and in others very low. And part of the problem of our healthcare system is, in fact, the lack of supervision at all levels. So we believe that in this case we mustn't compromise. Within the next 3 years, we must ensure that all our facilities have some form of quality supervision or the other. So that's at the quality level, Chair. The fourth priority says overhaul the health system and its management. Now, it's a very, very powerful word to use, overhaul the health system. Now, it's a very deliberate thing, because somehow, when you're not just trying to patch here and there, you're trying to actually change direction and therefore overhaul the system as a whole. So you'll see that it focuses on strengthening financial management systems and budget control, monitoring provincial expenditure patterns on a monthly basis, working with provinces and district management teams to ensure that their management teams in every district and of course, these are recognizable, and strengthening hospital management by ensuring not only, these are highlights, but not only that we put hospital management in training, But to ensure that all those CEOs that are appointed are appointed appropriately with proper qualifications and that they are supported so that the hospitals and clinics are actually functioning very well. So if you look at it, this is largely on the financial side. But again, I was saying some of these issues are related to positioning for the implementation of the National Health Insurance, whatever form it is implemented in. So it's both a standalone and as a strategy to overhaul the system to gear it towards a new financing arrangement, which is the National Health Insurance. On the human resource planning and development side, this is an area that I'm sure all of us are aware of, that we have a challenge in terms of our human resources. Let me start with bullet five, because that's the challenge that we've just come out of, and that is the, that we about to come out of. to correct myself, that is the finalization and the implementation of OSD for doctors, dentists, pharmacists, and EMS personnel. And then for other outstanding categories of health workers. Now, honorable members, this particular matter, OSD, is a government initiative. It's government that decided, when other people were sitting on the other side negotiating on behalf of the unions, it's the government that decided, honorable chair, that we think the problem with our professionals in the system is that they reach a certain ceiling, and the only way to go up after that ceiling is to get into management. The resulting outcomes of that are that, for example, if you look at our highest professionals in the area of health, they would actually be placed at a level which is comparative to certain mid-level or low-level managers in the system. So whether it is in education, in correctional services, in police, in engineering, in social work, as well as in health, this government decided to actually create a framework for a dispensation for professionals, for occupation-specific arrangements. So OSD, first of all, is a baby of the government. Secondly, after resolution one of the after that resolution, which dealt with OSD, implementation challenges, particularly in health, on the OSD for nurses, led to us agreeing with our colleagues in the unions, yes, that the government was delaying in a way, but that they were also contributing to the delay. If you like, 60%, 40%, 80%, 20%, whatever. But the delay is not just on the side of government, but because of the problems of implementation of the OSD for nurses, then we had to delay with the OSD for medical doctors. Thirdly, let me also emphasize that we all know, as honorable members, that currently we have a problem. It's a self-created problem, yes, but we do have a problem. And the problem relates to what people, in terms of numbers, in terms of location, and in terms of proper classification, what people do we employ in the system? In health, particularly for doctors, dentists, pharmacists, and that category, people have been employed in different ways for different reasons, so that it's not uncommon to find that somebody is occupying a post of some manager of a clinic, but is actually a chief specialist in a particular hospital. And secondly, it's not uncommon to find that the same person, or a person with the similar qualifications, similar experience, is employed and paid at a certain level in this province, which is quite different from the level they are paid in another province. It's actually a common thing. And that's caused by the fact that provinces, particularly those rural provinces, fighting very hard to try and keep their personnel, which is limited, then they do all sorts of creative things in order to actually improve their level. Whereas the provinces, the terminology that was used in health, and I think at some point it was banned, but for my purposes I'll use it. The G8 provinces, Gauteng, Western Cape, etc., would have the capacity and the money to be able to employ people at a certain level. If you take the EMS, for example, the Western Cape employs emergency medical service personnel far above everybody else in the country. So one of the things that we were trying to do in this OSD is to ensure that we first level the playing field, create a parity across the board, across provinces, across everything else. Now, one of the delays is to actually find these doctors in person, ensure that we know their numbers, where are they. Some of them are actually against posts of clerks, etc. So this issue of the personal system and how many doctors we employ has nothing to do with the fact that the Director General is paid a million or so rents, but doesn't know how many doctors he employs. It has something to do with the fact that we have a system, the personal system, in fact, that has been, for various reasons, rendered unreliable for ensuring what numbers we employ. So we are finishing the OSD. We've put it on the table. We've signed it. We're waiting for unions to respond and sign. They're complaining here and there, but I can tell you this deal, in my view, is the best deal that they could actually ever get under the current circumstances. All sorts of other things being equal, that they got this deal, if I was a union leader, I would have signed it yesterday before it withdrawn. But that's another objective, to then finish the other categories. The rest, in terms of human resource planning, relates to the implementation of the national framework for norms and standards, etc., the support for HR plans for 9 provinces, and the implementation plan for the national strategy to address the country's needs for various categories of nursing, including the finalization of the audit of nursing colleges. Now, let me again dwell on this issue of nursing for a minute. The honourable members will recall that in our last in the previous government, the former president had actually directed that all nursing colleges be reopened, and again in the State of the Nation address, the current one talks about the reopening of nursing colleges. And of course, people have said, what's happening is these officials are very defiant. The president speaks and they don't do. So we would like to submit that indeed we have done and we're continuing to do. The reopening of nursing colleges, in our view, means a number of things. First, the physical reopening of colleges that were closed, and we can say that one has been done. If a college had been closed and nothing had happened to it and it needs to be reopened, you'll find that in certain provinces that has happened. But colleges were not just closed. Some of them were amalgamated to other things, the universities, etc., etc. If you are in the Western Cape, you know what happened to the colleges in the Western Cape somewhere there. And therefore, the question is not to simply say, let's reopen that college, because even the infrastructure doesn't exist anymore. It is actually redeployed to the university, and the university is using it for other reasons. So for us, the reopening of nursing colleges also means re-establishing new colleges for nursing. And therefore, it will relate to audit, to the audit question, as it says, finalize the audit of nursing colleges, not only to talk about their quality, but also the needs that are there for training, and what form of training we want to have in this day and age in terms of our national qualification framework, including whether you're going to go back to the notions of training in nursing colleges in hospitals, within hospitals, as has been happening in the past. So the reopening of nursing colleges is more a concept about reopening of different kinds of training for nursing other than universities. That's what it is, objectively speaking, and therefore that's what we are working on. So I thought I should actually explain that a little bit more. And the rest, of course, is self-explanatory. Now, revitalization of health infrastructure, we continue with the revitalization program. You've heard that the president has actually talked about working on public-private partnerships, so we're going to work on those. But we continue with the work that we're doing in terms of the hospitals that are actually listed there. And then we're also going to try and see whether we can include 3 hospitals per province in the 2009-2010 project and at these various stages that are actually given in that paragraph. So we continue with our revitalization infrastructure, including also beginning to conduct an audit on the PHC infrastructure, primary healthcare infrastructure, so as to ensure that we do not have a situation where the clinics that we build are also needing to be revitalized because of problems of maintenance. And those that were built long ago are now collapsing. So we're starting a kind of audit on clinics. Priority number 7, accelerated implementation of the HIV and AIDS and TB as well as other communicable diseases. Here, these are priorities that were set in the National Strategic Plan for HIV, and they are all given there. 80% of pregnant women tested for HIV and having access. So these are access issues, and ARV treatment in particular. This is the PMTCT program largely. Now we'll come back to this when we talk figures, but in terms of the financing part of it, that's what we want to talk about more than the targets, because the targets are actually well known, they are public knowledge. If you look at priority number 7, continuing with regard to TB, it's the same issue. We have a national strategic plan for TB. We also have the emergency plan that we were implementing from last year. And so we continue with that work, including strengthening our analysis of MDR and XDR TB. But also we have an evaluation of our TB program, which is underway as we're speaking from today. We have an international group of people evaluating our program, and we'll report finally on the 17th as to what the quality of our program is. And of course, you'll see that the FIFA Soccer World Cup features into this area, because the main issue around the World Cup is to ensure that we prevent the spread of communicable diseases in the country. And you'll see the Confederation Cup took place in the context of the pandemic H1N1. And of course, our health services acquitted themselves very, very well in this regard. We are now seeing, after the World Cup, a whole range of cases. I think we've now reached 11 or 12, if I'm not mistaken, of identified H1N1 cases. All 10 of which, the first 10, have been people who come from the UK or the US and come into the country. I think only in this weekend, in some event that took place, I think it was an athletics event, did we identify 4 cases, 3 of whom were South African, and 1 probably Zimbabwean, that were identified at that athletics event. And there were mild cases of H1N1, and the investigations are still going on as to where they actually got that H1N1, because it's not clear who their contacts were, because then that would mean that we're beginning to see a community. If they are South Africans and they have not traveled anywhere and they have not come into contact with anybody other than perhaps the first case that could have come into contact with somebody, then we might actually be seeing the first cases of community of H1N1 in the local communities. But we are investigating that. We believe that it's not the case yet. So that issue of the FIFA Soccer World Cup, Dr. Tate is sitting at the back. She is the chief commander of all the armed forces fighting any communicable disease from being imported, especially with regard to 2010. And therefore, she'll answer questions on that one. I'll defer to her. See, the women command. maternal and child and women's health is also another priority, particularly in relation to the MDGs. We know our performance in this area, and these are the targets and this is a very, very important focus area. You'll see it in the context of PMTCT, but you'll also see it as a standalone here, focusing on other issues related to maternal and child health and women's health as such. And I'm not going to say much about that. Health promotion programs, the mass mobilization for better health, alcohol abuse, tobacco control, safer sexual practices, substance abuse, all those issues. And the healthy lifestyle strategy continues to be implemented. And diabetes is one of the key areas of focus, and I think the honorable members will relate better to that issue of diabetes. For one reason or the other, we shall remain nameless, but that's an issue that is a priority. The review of the drug policy also relates to the implementation of the new act, which was passed by this parliament in relation to the establishment of a new MCC, the Medicines Control Council, but also just looking at the drug policy from production to supply to the supply chain itself, and right up to ensure that there are no stockouts in the system. We're reviewing the whole system and revamping it, overhauling it in order to ensure that there are no stockouts, unnecessary stockouts in the system. If there are stockouts in inverted commas, it should be because there's a stockout of finance, but not a stockout in one facility when there's storage in the storage facilities, which is actually often the case in some instances. Research and development, we continue to ensure that we understand better what's happening in the system, commission research studies in various ways, and in this regard, this is where you will find more research into the traditional or African traditional medicines and other related substances, as well as other surveys that we do in order to understand what is happening in the system. So those are the 10 priorities, Chairperson. Now, these 10 priorities, I've been slowly explaining them and taking my time, but they must be supported by a budget. So what is the budget to do all these things and others? And I want honorable members to remember that these are priorities. The Department of Health also continues to prioritize maintenance things. Now, by maintenance things, I mean the things that will make the system work. For example, we must continue to ensure that we pay salaries in the system. We must continue to ensure that we issue licenses for pharmacists and for doctors that are dispensing. That's also a priority, but we don't put it up here because it's a maintenance job. We have to do it anyway. If we don't do it, the system will collapse. So there are many other things that I haven't put here that are actually maintenance, that are our day-to-day work. To ensure that the system actually continues. Now, to talk about the budget, I'm now handing over to the acting CFO to take us through that, Chair, through you. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members. What we have put up there is the budget for the financial year 08-09. Meaning the prior financial year, for the National Department of Health, excluding the conditional grants. Members who are aware would note that the actual budget of the National Health Department is 15 billion, but of the 15 billion, 1.2 billion is for management at National Health. The rest is for conditional grants. So the performance for the previous financial year, 08-09, was at 96%. And then, can we go to the next slide? This is just a breakdown of that summary that indicates the economic classification of that 1.2 billion, how it was spread between personnel expenditure, which is compensation of employees, goods and services, and other economic classifications. Now, on the 96% expenditure part, outcome for 08-09, I can see that. Thank you, Titi. The under expenditure of 4% was actually here. I mixed up the issues. This one is the under expenditure of conditional grants of the 15 billion that I referred to. That is because of the funding that was withheld for the revitalization grant. As the DG indicated, that happens at provincial level, as well as some 10.2 million that was withheld for the forensic pathology services for the provincial grant. That is the 15 billion. But the next bullet now talks directly to the 4% under expenditure of National Health, which was the 1.2 billion in the previous slide. This was due to the fact that we could not finalize the move of the department in the three buildings we are renting currently in the CBD in Pretoria to our building, Civitas. We did not manage to do that during the financial year 08-09 because of the delays with the contractors and public works. We are expecting that should be done this current financial year, and rollovers have been requested from Treasury for the both, actually, even for the conditional grants. This slide indicates the pressures that are experienced at National Health, specifically in key projects that were earmarked to be implemented in the financial year 08-09. They total 159 million. Over and above those highlighted projects, the department had a vacancy rate of 25%. That is National Health, not the health sector, including the provinces. This is the trend of audited financial years of 05, 04, 05 would be actual, and the 09-10 and 10-11 are the projections for the MTF allocations. So it indicates how much the department was was allocated. That is the NDOH, which is 1.3 billion in 04-05, which is currently at 1.4 for 09-10 for the department, and it also goes to the provinces, starting at 40 billion for 04-05, coming to 77.1 or 0.2 for 09-10, and the others, other health sector expenditure and budget. So the picture we are putting here is to say that there hasn't been a growth that is expected in the health sector. If you look at the last column, total percentage of GDP, we are currently during the financial year 09-10 at 8.2. Others say 8.5% of the GDP. Of expenditure, sorry, not budget, expenditure of the GDP. So the sector is actually saying there's no growth. Despite all the challenges that the DG has already put forward, there is no growth in financing the health sector. That is what we wanted to put across there. On this slide, we want to indicate the MTF allocations for the current financial year and the two consecutive years. At the top there, you see the allocation for the entire department. Per program, we have six programs. The first program is administration, which is 236.5 million. Strategic health programs, 4.6 billion. And the reason for why this program is so high is because it has the bulk of the conditional grants, specifically the HIV and AIDS and the communicable diseases grants. Health planning and monitoring has 357 million. Health human resource management, 1.7 billion. And the health services, the largest at 9.8 or 10 billion. This is where you find the revitalization grant, hence the bulk amount. And then the last program, the program six, is the international relations and health trade and health product regulation at 86 million. Total being 17 billion for the current financial year. Within that allocation, there are those priority areas. Some of them, as I've already said, they are at provincial level. Comprehensive HIV and AIDS received an additional allocation of 3.4 billion for the current financial year. And those are the other allocations for forensic and all the other conditional grants. I'd like to indicate the 50 million for the disaster management for cholera. That is a once-off allocation, mainly for the Limpopo.
What is Limpopo?
Limpopo disaster outbreak for the cholera. It does not include Mpumalanga because it came later after the allocations were done. Thank you. Next slide. Okay, this is an indication of some of the priority areas that we submitted bids to the National Treasury and were successful in. Although in the next slide, you will see how much we had requested them, the outcome, the comparison between what we have requested from Treasury and the outcome. However, this, can we go back? This is the actual allocation that we received for the three financial years of the MTF, the highest being HIV and AIDS. However, you will see in the next slide that the department is not sufficiently or adequately funded in with regard to that grant. Next slide, thanks. Okay, this is a slide that just shows the trend that is directly linked to the previous one of the JVP. We can pass this one. Just to indicate the pressure that the sector is experiencing here, prior years 07-08 continue into 09-10, and 09-10 now. What we want to indicate here is that year in, year out, the department, specifically at provincial level, experience over expenditure and now increasing accruals because most provinces would withhold payments towards the end of the financial year when they see that they are overspending in order to fit into the budget allocations in terms of the PSMA. However, similarly, they don't pay creditors. I'm sure members have seen in the media that some creditors haven't been paid and that is causing problems, then the result of that withholding of payments increases the accruals. So we go into the next financial year already with a deficit. So we use the allocation of the current financial year to pay prior old debt. So it's a vicious cycle. It goes year in, year out. We've experienced that since 2007. It's continuing in the current financial year. And the pressure areas, compensation of employees, as the DJ has already indicated, is OSD. The fuel increase, all of us are aware of that, and we are all suffering from that, as well as a high inflation rate. We can go to the next slide. Those are the pressure areas in terms of the programs in the department where we are saying as a department that we are not adequately funded. Next slide. This is the picture at provincial level. This is the outcome at financial year 08-09. The provinces spent 101.8% of their total allocation from a 73.5 billion allocation or budget. And you will see in the next slide the pressure areas will be the compensation of employees, which is directly related to OSD and the employment of new health professionals. So this is the picture per province, and this is what the outcome per province on the personal expenditure. So they spent 105. It's higher than the overall of 101%. This is where the pressure is actually, 105%. Mainly, I don't know if members are aware, this is the main pressure for the OSD for last financial year was for the nurses. There was quite a high number of over expenditures that we're still dealing with legally and otherwise at provincial level. Next slide. And then the capital expenditure, the department in the health sector is actually acknowledging that we have limitations and challenges with regard to our expenditure pattern for capital, because there's a pattern over the previous years that we don't spend 100% of the allocated. Mostly it's with the result of contracts either delaying the tender processes, delayed tender processes, or performance of contractors. This is the reasons given by the provinces for underspending their capital expenditure. Thank you. Okay, this is the outcome of expenditure for 08-09 for the conditional grants. I've already alluded to that, so I won't dwell much on it. I've already talked about the pressures in terms of the allocations for OSD, HIV and AIDS. I indicated earlier that we will reflect on how much we requested, especially for the adjustment budget for HIV and AIDS for the financial year 08-09. The department put in a request of 1 billion based on the challenges that we're experiencing largely with the ARV, but we only managed to receive 300 million from Treasury in terms of what was available there at the time. We also requested 350 million for child mortality vaccines. We only received 50 million that we managed for the adjustment budget of 08-09. Next slide, thanks. These are highlights for the bids that we submitted to Treasury for the current financial year. We only picked up the ones that have serious implications or impact to the patients at provincial level. For instance, with the comprehensive HIV and AIDS grants or program, the department submitted for the current financial year a bid of 1.4 billion. That is the highlighted bullet number two. And we only received 200 million, as you saw in previous slides. So the implications thereof is that the plans that the provinces have in the rollout have to be now done in a slower pace, in a phased-in approach, and that the drugs become a major cost driver for the patients. Earlier, the DG referred to the fact that our mission is actually to do preventive health programs, to focus more on preventive health programs. However, we find ourselves focusing on treating the patients, and the bulk of our expenditure or the cost driver goes to drugs, specifically in this program. With regard to the previous program, the conditional grant hospital revitalization, we had to cut our allocations This was already allocated by Treasury, and then they had to take the money back because of the recess. And we had to cut 19 million from Western Cape. This was negotiated and discussed with the province, so they are fully aware for the current financial year. And the next financial year, 2010-11, Limpopo is the one that will be affected. We're reducing 21 million from them, and Mpumalanga will be affected in the outer year with 22 million. And then with the continue with the hospital revitalization grant, the impact of the underfunding is that the targeted hospitals, some of them which the DG referred to, will not be achieved. What it means is that we will only do first phase or second phase instead of doing the planned agreement with the provinces and the then provincial treasuries. Thank you. Next slide. Then there's the National Tertiary Services Grant, which is looking at tertiary services at provinces. And the intention, by the way, of this grant is to minimize the pressure and the, I would say, in quotes, migration of patients into Western Cape and Gauteng, which are the two provinces, not the G8, the two provinces which have the, the two provinces which have the resources and the facilities, as in tertiary hospitals. So where all other provinces which are in the rural areas which do not have those centralized hospitals, they refer their patients to mostly these two provinces. This grant, the intention of this grant is to ensure that those services are decentralized, are taken to the rural areas. However, the funding is a problem there. We are not able to achieve what we intended because those are the funding gaps. For the prior financial year, it was 2.2 billion, current financial year 2.6, and the next financial year 3.6 billion. And those are the implications for this underfunding for this tertiary services. And as a result, the provinces are experiencing this pressure and therefore moving funds from primary health care to deal with the patients which are supposed to be treated at tertiary level. It's a bit of an unfair situation for the provinces because they only have equitable share allocation. They are not expected to be really treating those patients because they don't have funding for that. Next slide, thanks. In summary on the financial status, the department is indicated that this one is a known point, that the OSD allocation for the doctors, dentists, and pharmacists was not sufficient, but the matter is being dealt with as we speak. And the challenge is therefore also to adequately fund the next groupings, which we are supposed to finalize during the current financial year. As indicated, we do not have adequate funding for HIV and AIDS, specifically the ART program, as well as the hospital revitalization grant. I'll stop there, TG. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Can I then conclude, Chair, by saying that we, in summary, we have therefore given the committee an account of the strategic plan for the National Department of Health, the 10-point plan of government, and I think we've also flagged some of the key issues that are emanating from the challenges of funding. The budget is a budget, we have to work with it, but we must always flag where there are difficulties. Of course, in relation to the HIV and AIDS situation in particular, because that's what usually picks up the headlines, and I'm aware the SAPC is here, so they're likely to also report on that issue. In relation to those matters where, in fact, you have an established right by virtue of our policy. If you, for example, read a city for count of 200 at the moment and you require treatment, it's a matter of right that you have that treatment. It's no longer a choice. So we are looking at other ways of dealing with that issue. For example, we are in discussion with a whole range of funders, development agencies that are funding in the area of HIV so that we can rationalize the millions of rands that are actually being used in HIV so that we can be able to cater for the number of patients that we are having. But as I say, and as the CFO has said, this issue of funding of drugs is not just about not just about HIV treatment. And of course, HIV treatment is seen to be a matter of life and death. There are other matters of life and death, such as diabetes, hypertension, and all those things. All other chronic illnesses, if they are affected by the underfunding, then you have a problem in the provinces because of the over expenditure. Hence, in the Free State, you had that problem, and again, it was reflected simply as an HIV problem. But it was a problem across the board. You couldn't actually just buy drugs, and some of the essential drugs, not just the ALT. So that issue we're highlighting, but we're working on it. And also highlighting that this year there's a very serious focus on ensuring that we have a single health plan or set of priorities. Therefore, the 10-point plan forms the basis for the next 5 years. It will therefore reflect perhaps in the next strategic plan that province A, province B, province C is going to achieve this, that, and the other in relation to priority number 1 up to 10, and therefore these are the national outcomes that we expect as a result of that. Well, thank you, Chair. My colleagues are here to assist in answering the questions from the honourable members. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much, DJ, for the presentation. And I must say before that, you know, it's as you said that you're supposed to be receiving this document 10 days before we come to the presentation. We'll still maybe communicate with your department because we cannot do a microscopic analysis of it now because we have just received this document, most of us, in the morning. So, but we will communicate with your office. We will keep on having discussions where we have problems. We will always come to your office. And I must say that we welcome the presentation, and we say this presentation was a people-centered presentation that has got to do with the aspirations as were promised to the people and following the 10-point priorities. Maybe before I call for clarity-seeking questions and comments on this, I will maybe go make my own comments and maybe seeking questions, clarity-seeking questions. On priority number one, we understand that it's more of leadership, and then we need to have a mechanism, as you indicated, of engaging the communities so that they have constructive feedback. We welcome that very much. But now when you talk of the training of hospital boards, you know, in some areas we don't even have this, we don't even know where these hospital boards are sitting. How are we going to make sure that this reaches those areas that are too rural, that are not from the G8 anyway? And saying that also, I'll link it this with a priority number two, where you are talking of a broader consultation with communities, the way we have public comments now, and the training of the hospital boards. And we have this also that is called AMA clinic committees. What kind of sampling maybe are you going to get so that everybody is being reached? And then asking in that fact, what is your relationship with the local government so that we can get this going on to ensure that every person is reached? Because structures are not vibrant, they are not formed, especially in rural areas. Ask me, I come from one of those areas. We only hear that there are these things, but we don't see them being implemented. So maybe what plans do you have in mind that those areas are also reached? And then coming to So to priority number three, you were talking about the some districts that are not performing. If maybe because here we represent the provinces, and we would be much happy if we can get information on those districts, which districts, so that we can be able to do our oversight duty on them to make sure that they are on par with other districts. Maybe we should know which we are talking about. Also under priority three, you talked about patient safety. I'm going to say this on patient safety. I don't know the relationship much between social services and the health service, but there's one thing that bothers me, you know, when we talk about the HIV infected people, you know, they do receive the grants, and on the day that they go for their grants at those areas there, you find that a patient very sick is lying on the ground, having been accompanied by one, you know, of the family members, and to me, that's sort of humiliation to the patient. So I don't know how you can, you know, try to assist in this case, talking to social services to make sure that this patient safety is secured, because taking these people very sick as they are, just to go and get their grants at the pay point is torture, from my experience coming from those rural areas where they even have to hire cars to take them there. Can there be no means of trying to meet them halfway, maybe get them being paid at home? But I know it's not entirely the health department's baby, but talking to social services, let's make sure that these people's safety is guaranteed. Anything can happen during that time. They need to be cared for. Priority number four, the overhauling. I know it's a job, but it's necessary. It's a necessary thing that we should undertake. You know, we are talking about the provinces paying differently, and this is saying there are disparities in terms of the skills shortages that we have in this country. And we should try and cap those skill shortages. But already you have indicated the bringing back of the nursing colleges. That will also assist to cap the fly-by-night, you know, colleges that we have in this country, where especially the victims become the children from the rural areas, because they've got to come to those G8 areas to find this tuition and things happen there, which we cannot continue to talk about here. We know what we are talking about. So let's keep the fly-by-night. Let's reintroduce those nursing colleges. We welcome that. And also look at the demographics of our country. You know, I will always emphasize on those rural areas there, where I come from. That will also assist in keeping the cost of transport, where the people have got to move from areas. Always, I'm coming from Mpumalanga in the area that is called former KwaNdebele area, and you have, you know, a lot of migrant laborers coming from KwaNdebele coming to this. Even learners move from that area in KwaNdebele, former KwaNdebele, to Pretoria. You can see that it's not something that augurs well to us. With this one of priority number six, the revitalization of clinics and so on, please, as the Department of Health, we will be doing oversight on you, but let's make sure that there is interaction also with the local government, because at local government level, that's where things don't go straight most of the time. And the program for TB on priority number seven, can we come maybe with a mechanism for this? You are saying 80% of the TB patient will be tested for HIV. I forgot the period, I'm not referring there. But I have a problem with the very same counselors that we have there. They seem not to be, the counselors seem not to be very capable. They don't have enough capacity to deal with their work as counselors, and that makes matters worse. That is why most of the patients would not agree to testing, because the councillors, honestly, I have a problem with not all of them, but somewhere it seems people are just taken there and there's a microwave in training, which is really not very necessary. We need an in-depth training for the councillors so that people become free when they do this thing. And lastly, I want to say thank you for prioritizing the pressure areas, you know, like HIV AIDS and TB, and saying so open to the honorable members to ask questions and maybe comment on the presentation that you said. We have some honorable member Nube, in that order. In that order, you are allowed. Thanks.
Thanks, honorable chairperson, the department and in charge. Chair, we will start with the with commending the department on prioritizing all the areas that we talked about from Bulugwane to the manifesto. And when we're doing door-to-doors, we brought hope to the people. However, Chairperson, when then comes the issue of budgeting, then that's where the hopes are becoming dished. And as we'll be getting to a recess next week, we can't be telling them that, hey, you still are going to have long queues. The question of the prioritization of dealing with HIV and AIDS, the manifesto talks about at least 80%. 80% of people living with HIV and AIDS, we have to deal with them. And but the question of the slide that you ended up with, on the implication of underfunding, the HIV 1 billion and you got 300 million. That is going to have a huge impact and a lot of noise that will come to say, hey, the previous president and now we have this one and we promised to roll out the implemented that strategy. And we have less money. We know it's not about you, but it's national treasury and the recession. But ordinary people, they don't know about that. Recession is a recession of America. How do we come there? When getting to door to door, we knew about recession, and we brought hope. So I'm not sure. I know there is an observer from planning and monitoring here to say how much more should we do as we do oversight to help Department of Health to live up to, I mean, the ANC in Bulugwane and the government priority is health is one of their priorities, health and education. However, when it comes to the practice then on budget, then that you are not realizing. Then that's one area. But I'll also link up the under-budgeting with the revitalization of infrastructure. When you go to the implications of underfunding, then the budget cuts get to the revitalization. Whether it is a question of that money being underspent and now the cut. But we also promised in the manifesto that prioritization of infrastructure will be the key issue. We know it's not only rural areas and also townships where the problem. So also that's another issue again that we promised that you are going to see change. And but when we then look into the budget, that is going to be affected. The other thing is on the private, what do you call it, Triple P. Yes. In your statement, you talk of guidelines on Triple P established, adopted, and implemented by province by March 2012. We are 2011, 2012. There's one last example that is very horrible, which happened last week. There's a domestic worker, Mavis Mude, who was run down by a car from the celebration of that soccer. The accident was in Fenton. The paramedics phoned Charlotte McClike, and they said it's full. The casualty is full. They then phoned Barra. Same answer, is full. And then they went back to Morningside. The accident happened next to Morningside. But because of class, this is domestic work. Because of class, they have to phone Charlotte Natrike. Because they couldn't phone immediately Morningside, because that domestic worker wouldn't be having a medical aid, wouldn't have been cash to pay. And at the end of being sent from pillar to post, they went back to Morningside. But the person who caused the accident, Boone, immediately, they did not think about phoning Charlotte Natrike or taking that person, the driver, to Charlotte Natrike. They immediately took him to a Morningside. It's a class issue, but also these people violated the paramedics and these hospitals. I don't think that morning Charlotte Natrike was full, but it was a question of, by the way, from these paramedics. It was a question of this is an African, a domestic worker, can't be having that money, which is a violation of the Constitution to say nobody will be sent back on an emergency. And Mavis died because of that thing. So the point I'm trying to drive at is that 2012, we may say by 2012, I don't think that it means that we can promote this, because when we're also doing door-to-door in terms of the National Health Insurance System, it was a question of it's being phased in for the next 5 years. But then when we say by 2012, that means we're still going to have more Mavis Mudes being the victims of saying it's a private hospital, you can't be taken there. So your timeline, whether it is your timeline, but it's the whole question of saying whoever must understand the clause in the question in terms of you can't turn away a person because of the level of the poor poverty. The other thing is the question of a filling of vacancies on the HR. I'm not sure whether the legal funding that you have got will also impact. There's a slide that you talk of the 25% staff, whatever, but you don't have funding for it. To me, we also talked about it in the manifesto. There's a priority in terms of there will be more staff so that we deal with the long queues. We deal with the distressed sector, because that's why nurses are impatient. That's why doctors leave patients with stomach open, because there are no drips. And one case also was the death of a brother to a regional secretary of SACAL in Gauteng, who died in April at Barra because of there were no drips. So this budget cuts, I mean, I know even the provinces will talk the same thing. The budget cuts will go to the question of we were lying to the people. We promised them on the manifesto, but things are just getting worse than they were. When you go to, if this budget cuts will affect more the G7, excluding the G2, Western Cape and Gauteng, it will affect mostly the G7, who will always then put pressure, will move from Limpopo and go to Gauteng and find Barafool. So the question of migration, unintended consequences, it's being applied here. The shortage of ambulances. A person died because there's no ambulance in Mpumalanga, the few, the only two, and they may not even with the little budget, they may not even prioritize it. And we have talked about that. On the OSD, you requested 2.5 billion and you got 1 billion. It just came from you that the delay was also the question of insufficient funding. I mean, the resolution was signed in 2007. It's 2009 now with the wild cat strikes and whatever. I know the doctors have given government up to the 25th of July or so. And exactly we know that with the G7 also there might be some problem, because this 1 billion, it will affect the other provinces to say there is no kit from the provinces, because it is provinces that are paying. So we're still going to have the mass rolling action that we know exactly that it's going to be coming. The other thing is, I raised it last week with the social development. It may not be for you, but they also referred it to you that it is a cross-cutting issue. The whole, and I know on the Bulukwana resolutions that it's saying we will no longer talk about it because it will be integrated with the social security net. The whole question of the grant given to patients that have CD4 count 200 and they qualify for that disability grant. And when we're doing door-to-door campaigning, the people were saying, we are unemployed. We are unemployed. And we are HIV positive. You get to CD4 count 200 and below. You qualify for ARVs. And you qualify for that disability grant. But as soon as your status, your health status improves, the grant gets withdrawn. It might be the question of the assumption that you were not working, you were working and now bedridden. Now as your CD4 count improves, you go back to work. But we know that close to 33% or 40% of people are being retrenched and are unemployed. So they were then saying, why do you take out this? Because as long as I'm eating the ARVs, I'm also supposed to be accompanying it with food and correct nutrition. So I raised it last week, but they're also saying, no, you're still going to be coming to talking to it jointly. So the lastly, Chairperson, I'm commending you on responding to the state of the nation on cutting on the consultants. I've seen zero. So I'd like to commend you for that. Thanks, Jefferson. Thank
you. I don't know. This aircon.
don't know whether it's made to freeze us or what. It's too much. Somebody should assist us, honestly. It's too much. We in that order. No, at least warmer.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. A very good presentation from the Department of Health, Director General. I just want to firstly check with the department as to whether this strategic plan is a 5-year framework. And then for the committee to be able to do oversight, I don't see how are we going to, you know, measure your performance. Because is there any document that as an operational document which talks to the threat plan? I just want to check that. And secondly, because in the strat plan you don't have, you know, targeted time frames. And then that is where we are not going to be able to measure your performance as a department. But Director General, in your drug plan, the issue of Batubili principle, the drug plan is quiet on that. And if you can go to hospitals, it's terrible. And even clinics, it's very terrible, really. The Batubili principle is not. There is a very serious non-adherence to it. And your drug plan is quite on that. You don't say anything about it. Or maybe you have thrown it away. I don't know. But I think it's a principle. It's a standing principle that should always, you know, be in our documents to reprimand our staff in hospitals. That this principle is a standing principle. It must be adhered to. The other question is, in relation to the time operation of clinics, particularly in the rural area. I'm from a rural area. The clinic is not operating 24 hours. And when you check with the nurses there, they will tell you, you will find a nurse there because there are some rooms where they sleep after they know of. But they won't assist you. They will tell you, they use another term of saying, I'm on waiting call, something like that. Waiting call or what? Something like standby. They will refer you to another clinic 5 kilometers away from the clinic where you are. It happened to me. And I don't know how do you intend to address this thing of, you know, clinics operating 24 hours. Because we don't only get sick during the day only. We get sick even during the night. And we need assistance. So I should think you will share information with us on that one. When I was saying about targets, in one of your slides you indicated you are going to employ 150 staff. I don't know, this 150 is for the next coming year or is for this financial year, because the draft plan is not clear on that. And then we should take us from that and tell us whether it's for the five-year plan, and if it's for the five-year plan or three-year MTF plan, at what number per quarter are you going to employ? Or for this financial year only, out of that 150, for this financial year only, what are you going to employ? If that number is for the five-year plan. I should think, Honorable Chair, most of the questions you covered. Thank you very much.
Honorable Member.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question is around the following. One death is too many, and I heard that in the area of the initiation school, already 33 young men died. What is the department doing actually to assist in that area to see that after the process is completed and then the healing must start, especially in that area? The other thing is the underfunding of our national tertiary services, the shortages in the medical staff. The budget, there's less money available now in these institutions, and we plan to get more medical staff in this area, and these tertiary services, they do a lot to get more medical people, especially in our clinics and hospitals. That is a concern, and the department must come up with a definite program to improve this, because I do understand that the effectiveness of the delivery in this department or these areas of department is very important. What effectiveness will there be in delivery of medicine due to the budgetary constraints? Because in certain areas in our more rural areas, there's always a problem in delivery of medicine. And I think due to this budgetary constraints, there will be more problem in delivery of medicine. The other thing is around the N1 virus now, Varkgriep is an Afrikaans genoem. Can the department elaborate more on the advocacy of programs to help the people out there if they identify anyone with the signs of this illness? What must they do? The other question is around the opening of the reopening of nursing schools. In what areas and in what province will this opening of nursing schools happen, and from when? Then the district doctors, especially at our clinics, where they must service the people who actually must apply for grants. Is there any monitoring measures to follow up if these district doctors are actually doing what they have to do, not just when the people arrive at the clinic, then they just do just a few minutes with the people, and then after that, then they write down that these people is actually not applicable to receive the grants, because most of our people,
especially also in the rural areas. There's a lot of problems around that. And the last question, Madam Chairperson, is around the patients lying on the floor of the hospital. And actually, we can see it also on TV, and that is not a good thing, especially for our country, because it is sending not a good understanding out to the world. What is the department actually doing when they is in some of our hospitals patients lying on the ground and to address that problem? Thank you very much.
Chairperson, I'll try as far as possible not to repeat what my honourable members have just asked, and maybe go straight to my three questions. And few of them I know they have been covered. The advocacy on swine flu, it's been asked. Maybe I'm also more interested to hear what the department is going to say about it. And the issue on the care of patients who are lying in hospital and these dirty hospitals and clinics. And Chairperson, I am mindful that the department and ourselves knows that a budget actually should be contextually valid. I am worried where I'm seated, Chairperson, asking myself questions. That how contextually valid is a budget presented to us today with a deficit upfront, and I'll be very much interested to hear the department clarifying this to me. The other question, Chairperson, it's a worrying factor, Chairperson, that government hospital has little potential to compete with private hospitals in terms of resources and personnel. And most of the colleagues have spoken into this item as well. But I just want to find out from the department, what measures do the department put in place to make sure that to correct these anomalies in the hospitals, to make sure that the private hospital and government hospital actually compete pound by pound on resources and personnel. And Director General spoke about the deficiency in the PSAR system. So what I want to know, what measures do they put in place to address that deficiency, to make sure that the PSAR feed them with the correct information in terms of these statistics. And lastly, Chairperson, do the department have sufficient budget to outrightly implement the OSD for doctors and other health personnel? I just want to find out, because from where I'm seated, I know that this is a 2007 resolution, but they find it so difficult to implement. I don't know whether do they have for this current financial year sufficient money to make sure that they implement this OSD in the health sector, so that to avoid all what we have seen over the TV about patients. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you, honorable members. Without wasting time, I'll ask the department to respond.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and honorable members for the question. let me start by saying, Chairperson, as we always predict, honorable members discuss the provinces more than the national budget, and
we understand the chair says the NCOP, the NCOP has section 74 and section 75. So in some instances, they would focus on national issues. But we understand why that is the case, Chair. It's because in the end, it points out to the priority number one, that in the end, we're talking about a health system, and that in the end, the National Department of Health should be able to account for whatever happens in the system, and therefore is responsible for it not happening, regardless of whether you have power to make it happen or not. And therefore, that's why we talked about priority number one. If that is the case, we must be able to match the two. If it's necessary to look at the legislative elements to do that, then one of the priorities is to look at the legislative framework to assist that kind of synergy. Because at the moment, we have the responsibility without power. That's not a very good situation to be at. I won't tell you what you compare that with for the sake of peace in this house. But the issue, I just wanted to say by way of responding, that most of the issues that have been raised suggest the importance of priority number one, so that we are able to have integrated plans and integrated health systems where we can be able to account for what happens in hospital, in a hospital in Babanango. Okay, having said that, on the first question about clinic committees, hospital boards, first let me say that a presentation of this nature highlights certain points. The exercise plan develops some others. So the real document that we need to look at is the set plan in detail. We've just picked up some points. Some of the issues here will be answered by that. So part of the issue of hospital boards and clinic committees, why we talked about priority one and ensuring that we have the partnership with communities, was precisely to ensure that these structures are revived everywhere, vibrant everywhere, in rural areas, in urban areas, and that they have actually teeth. And in order for us to do that, we won't be able to do it simply from a government point of view. We need political parties. We need civil society to be able to mobilize communities so that the communities can actually participate. This is community democracy. It's people-centered democracy. And therefore, part of the partnership and the social compact we're talking about is so that the honorable member can go and develop those assistance, get the partners in those areas, so that we can partner with them in ensuring that there's a vibrant clinic committee. In some rural areas, these clinic committees are functioning better than in the urban areas. Some of them are actually the center of our, both the clinic gardens and the school nutrition gardens. The clinic committees are actually, the clinic is the site of vegetable development, both for our ARV patients as well as the school children. So we've seen this thing happening, and if we can ensure that all of us mobilize that these things work, including local government in that regard. Now, talking about local government, the role of local government in health, also in relation to priority number one, where we talked about clarifying certain definitions and all sorts of things like that. That relates also to us making sure that there is a clear relationship between local government and its role in health and the intergovernmental space that we have to operate under, including, for example, the questions relating to the objective of a single public service. So that's, as I said, was actually trying to capture all those issues. On the second question, we will provide a list of the districts together with their characteristics, why they were chosen, et cetera, to the honorable members, the 18 districts.
Now, the honorable members talk about the issue of social grants in two ways. One, in the manner in which those grants are actually delivered to patients, not only HIV patients, but patients who are TB patients in hospitals, etc., etc. We have looked at this matter with the Department of Social Development, and I hope the conversation still continues. For example, in terms of the hospitals, we have been worried that our TB patients every month end want to leave the hospitals, particularly your XDR, MDR TB patients, to go home because they have to go in queue for those and then come back to hospital. And we have been saying there must be other ways of delivering that service. That we are working on. In some hospitals, they've already started actually ensuring that they pay those grants in the hospitals. When it comes to the homes, we also have to actually work with the department to see what other mechanisms can be achieved so that people who are patients do not have to be lying in those areas queuing for grants. That's the one aspect of the grant issue. The second one on grant withdrawal, Honorable Busisiwe. The issue has been on the table for some time now. I think it's in the last 3 or 4 years, if I'm not mistaken. And it was also taken to the SANAC, the South African National AIDS Council, for advice. And I think they have now developed a proposal, which we are supposed to be considering in the next plenary session, the next Program Implementation Committee session of the South African National AIDS Council. The difficulty with this kind of grant is that, first of all, it is a disincentive for people not to remain on treatment in order for them to keep their CD4 count low so that they can actually qualify. Because the grant is not an HIV grant. It's a temporary disability grant. So, as long as it's a temporary disability grant, legally, you have to discontinue it when the disability that is temporary is actually no longer there. Now, when you define disability, you don't define it in terms of inability, no, in terms of not working. You define it as disability. It doesn't matter whether you're working or not working. So, in that sense, the discontinuation has nothing to do with the assumption that you are now able to go and look for work. It has something to do with the definition of disability, temporary disability. And therefore, the issue of chronic illnesses, the grant for chronic illnesses, basically because of a variety of things. One, because it's costly for somebody to be sustaining a chronic illness in the one sense. Secondly, that it would cost the state more not to keep that person on medication as such. And thirdly, of course, as you say, that some of those people are in the context of poverty, unable to then sustain their treatment because they do not have food as such. That creates problems. So that issue, they are right, the Department of Social Development is right that we are getting ready to make a proposal on it. Actually, in our previous life, prior to May 11 or something like that, when the new government was sworn in. Prior to that, we had a social cluster, and the social cluster had been responsible for this matter. Now, it's actually a responsibility of the social protection and community development cluster. So they will come back with that matter. Of course, we contribute as the Department of Health. But the main issue about that grant, indeed, is that it's because we are using a wrong mechanism to address a particular issue. The other problem with it is, of course, that's why we talk about chronic illnesses. Because the same thing applies to your TB patients, by the way.
Same thing applies to other patients with chronic illnesses, diabetes being one of them, which is now becoming a major presence even among the poor. It used to be a sickness of the rich, but the kind of diet that we have now is actually causing a lot of problems. So it's an issue that is being looked at. It's a difficult issue. It's a complex issue, but let's hope they'll come up with something. The Fly By Night Colleges, the Nursing Council is working with us on this matter. And of course, I agree with you that once we establish public nursing colleges as we did before, it eliminates this element of our tutors running out and opening colleges and giving funny qualifications to our people. So that's going to help. On the revitalization and the interaction with local government, in some instances we have a very good relationship with local government on these matters. But in others, of course, local government doesn't feature, and that's why there's a larger issue here of what is the role of local government in health, not simply in the clinics that they run, but in health in general, as such. And that's an issue that we're trying to resolve. Capacity of the councillors, I think it's a matter that we must actually take on. We will look into it and see how we can improve on that one. On this issue of the budgets and the budget cuts, etc. Look, I think generally, first of all, we're making two points here. The first point that we're making is that we believe that the health budget has now returned to the levels in which it was in 1996. First it dipped from 1996 and now it's back at those levels. But it doesn't match the current challenges, the burden of disease and all sorts of other things. But whether that can be answered by the fiscus alone is still a question, and perhaps that's why the view of the mandating party was that you need to actually see if you can't pool, as in POOL, all the resources on health in the country through some mechanism, and the NHI being that mechanism. Because in terms of demand that we have in the country, the fiscus may not be able to meet. Well, we can ask for more money from the Treasury, yes. And we must continue doing so. But in reality, the challenges that we have here require that we also draw from some of the resources in one way or the other, either by pooling, I'm saying that was the other choice, or by doing other things to ensure access to those funds or those resources that are in the private sector. So the issue should be broader than simply under-budgeting by the Treasury. Of course, as I say, we'll continue to talk about perhaps more money for health. But I think the issue also sits with the honorable members. We didn't show a slide here, which, and in fact, I think it is there, and we'll have to check, which actually shows the relationship between the contribution of health or social services, particularly health, to the equitable share. That and what actually goes to health when it comes to the province. You'll see that some provinces do not try to attempt to keep that relationship, so that your contribution of the equitable share may be 30% if you like, but when it comes to the actual allocation in the province, it goes down to 24% or something like that. So some of the issues relate to that, to simply, if you were to get what is due to health in terms of its contribution to the equitable share, that's number one, then maybe you would see an improvement in some of the provinces. Secondly, also, when you have a situation where certain funds are allocated for certain functions, but are put into the equitable share, and then they get lost because they're used, diverted, used for other things, then you still have another problem where you can't say we're moving from this point to the other. So I'm trying to suggest that this issue of budgeting and budget cuts is not a simple and straightforward matter of recession. But thirdly, I think we must at the moment, currently, not be very hard on that issue, because as I said, this allocation of the budget was more or less presented in February, prior to the implementation of the prioritization. So in other words, what we are going into the budget process with this time, and therefore this committee would have to do that when we meet next year, whoever they meet in this as they deal with the budget, the issue would have been whether that budget has prioritized health and education. That would be very critical, because then the opportunity for this government to reflect that in reality is now there. Yes, now it's now there. So you can see that for now, maybe that prioritization is something that will be reflected in the next financial year. Nevertheless, to deal with the specific questions, the question of whether the under-budgeting with revitalization, is it because of the underspending that we have the budget cut? Yes and no. On the one hand and on the other hand. On the one hand, yes, in the sense that when those cuts were done, it was based on the expenditure patterns and the possibilities of whether that money would be spent within, rather put it somewhere else than, so that would be the, but the issue of the revitalization program per se, and the pace at which it is going, and therefore the investment that we're putting into it, in our view, we could improve on that, because if we go at the current pace, then it means it will take us more than 30 years to revitalize our hospitals and our clinics. So there is an issue there, and of course that is why the call for other mechanisms for funding, you'll see that's what we say there, including PPPs. Now, to come to this issue of PPPs and Mavis and the tragic death of Mavis Ncube, who bears no relative to the person who was asking the questions. I've investigated. There are three issues that arise there, and I'm sure my colleagues also would want to comment on this, especially Dr. Chetty. But there are three issues that arise from this. The first one relates to the issues you identified, where people do not follow the law and the rules as they are supposed to follow them. I think in some of these cases, one of the things that we can actually do is indeed to take on those people that don't do that, so that there's a consequence to such action. As long as there's no consequence, people will always do this thing and phone that one. I think paramedics know that their task is to stabilize the patient, get to the nearest emergency place for stabilization, and then talk all these other issues that are actually there. That's the one thing. So if we don't deal with those paramedics, who actually don't do their duty, then we will always have these mavises that we're talking about. So that's the first issue. I think the second issue relates to, I think you are correct in relating to the relationship between the public sector and the private sector. Where, for example, the private sector would want to be assured some kind of payment for their services. This issue was addressed in the processes we were undertaking in our health charter. And we had looked at all sorts of things relating to these issues, such as access to the nearest facility, and what, regardless of payment or non-payment, and that would be a matter between government and the institutions. And we're going to work out the mechanisms. Unfortunately, that process was stalled in relation to that. So we would need to actually look at how to strengthen those relationships in the meantime. But thirdly, part of the issue that people believe will be addressed by a single fund, the sort of National Health Insurance Fund, a single payer model and so on, is precisely to avoid this kind of thing, because the service providers will be providing a service, all of them guaranteed, whatever is guaranteed for that service. If they are accredited by one fund to pay for that service, then they will render the service regardless of who comes in there, wherever they are. So in other words, those issues would not even arise if you had a different arrangement of the financing of healthcare. So that issue. But in the meantime, we need more concrete cases where we can take them on and take the hospital on for letting people not stabilized or die as a result of the fact that it said this person has no medical aid, pass them on when they were in a state of emergency. If we do not have those cases, just like the cases that are being dealt with by the Competition Commission, if we don't deal with those cases of price collusion in the country, it will continue. And you must actually find those people very hard for those kinds of conduct. And I think the case of Mavis may do to deal with this issue if we've got the evidence. You will note that when we talked about the filling of vacancies, in here we were talking about the vacancies in the national department. We said 25% unfunded. In fact, we shouldn't be calling them vacancies. We should say unfunded posts. So in other words, we have a deficit of 25% that we have identified at the moment to execute our task. In fact, there's more than that, but from the premise that where we sit, those that we've identified now but we couldn't get funding for, and therefore we're sitting at a point where, in fact, at the moment we are overspending as National Department on our current personnel expenditure. This phenomenon you'll find in many provinces. You'll find an over expenditure on personnel, yet they say they've got vacancies. What they mean is that the capacity to deliver the service requires more posts, but they are not funded. Unfortunately, we always say, because we're also an employer this time, and we hope you're also acting on behalf of the employer and not any other interest. As the employer, we say it's very dangerous to say these are vacancies, because the unions will pick up that resolution and say you were supposed to fill these by a certain time. So it's a risk to say they are vacancies. But at the same time, not to say that we are understaffed is also a risk. So I think we are balancing those two. Now, the issue in relation to that suggests that we need to do a real serious analysis of our capacities, personnel capacities. And we are doing that at the moment. We are analyzing where these personnel costs are coming from in the provinces and what is causing this, this gap in personnel so that we can actually have a much more scientific explanation of the understaffing, if it is understaffing, and therefore underfunding as such. And of course, you write also in saying that the budget cuts will also affect the migration patterns as people begin to try and look for service elsewhere. We're trying to deal with this issue by ensuring that we have the capacities where the people are at. In fact, we believe that most of the needs that people have can be dealt with at a local level if you strengthen it. Strengthen your district health system, strengthen your PHC, and people, to a point where people have confidence in it, then you will have dealt with all the problems that you're talking about in hospitals. Not all as in the majority. Let me say the majority of them. Your queues in many of the hospitals are caused by people who shouldn't be in hospital, who should actually be getting a better quality service at a lower level. So part of the issue of dealing with those things relates to that, and we have this quality improvement program is trying to deal with that. Now, finally, the OSD resolution and the fact that we're going to expect more mass action. I'm also going to answer the honorable member who asked whether we have enough money. Look, we have negotiated and we have put proposals on the table. And we've reached a point where on all the matters, we agreed with the union that we have covered all ground of negotiation and we have reached a point where we can put a final draft resolution. We've put the final draft resolution with its financial implications, which means that money, we have a mandate to spend, so it must be there somewhere, because the mandate has been given. And we have signed on our part that resolution. The normal thing is for unions to go and consult and get a mandate. You've heard that COSATU and the COSATU unions have been calling on all unions to sign that agreement. But of course, it would be unstrategic to be a unionist who rushes to go and sign. You must go and convince the people that you have you can sign that agreement, and if you feel you can't, then you hedge and hedge and hedge until the employer implements unilaterally. Of course, then the members don't blame you for signing something that they didn't like, but at the same time, you're happy that it's being implemented because you've negotiated and you know you can't negotiate more. So I think we're at that stage now. We're at the stage where the unions are trying to get the mandate. And of course, unfortunately, they are dealing with a very difficult constituency. Because you see, you need a constituency that has understood the dynamics of labor relations in this country and therefore understands what unionism means. I'm not saying the doctors don't understand that. I'm simply saying many of them are new in that kind of arena. And therefore, somehow you can see that all of us have to be understanding that we're dealing with a sector. First of all, the first thing that happened is a strike. And people are excited about being on strike. Long before there's any negotiation, they start with a strike. And of course, the implications of that kind of thing for our labor relations environment are actually vast. You've seen unions that are matured. They know what happens when you have to go on strike. These ones say, well, because we have a good cause, all unions have a good cause, I can assure you. They always have a good cause for the demands they make on the table. So it's not just because you have a good cause that then you have a right to go on strike, on an unprotected strike. But we understand, you see, we understand. So I don't think we'll have that mass mobilization to a point where on the 25th we'll have another massive national strike. If we do, then it will be a pity as a country. Of course,
we should avoid a doctor strike. It's the worst strike you can have. Emergency services, worst strike you can have. So I'm gonna do that. So I think we're very much aware of that. So the next question now is this a 5-year framework, and what are the measures, operational plans, et cetera, timeframes and targets? Let me say, I think we distributed this document, and if you look at it, it's an MTEF strategic plan, 2009 to 2012. And in each one, for each of those years, you'll see that you've got targets. They are provided. If you then look at the actual strat plan with targets under the programs, program one up to program six, you'll see that there are measurables, there are expected outcomes, program outputs, indicators, targets for the next 3 years. So what I did, as I said, was to operate at for presentation purposes, to say these are the priorities. But if you go deep, then you'll see for each of those priorities, you locate them within the program. There are targets that are actually given. 3-year targets, starting from this annual target. Now, from the point of view of the monitoring of the committee, we don't move to the operational plan where we say from the first quarter we're going to do this, that, and the other. We're just supposed to be showing the annual, the 3-year plan with the annual target, which is what we've done. But we for our own purposes, then, can do the monitoring of the program implementation at an operational level. But the committee can call any time to say, where are you with this program? If you say you're going to beat 150 hospitals this year, in 2 months' time, we can call these people and say, how far are you? Have you built 10? It looks like you are too slow. So it's that is the idea. So the actual strategic plan will show you what the targets are. Some of them, of course, are expressed in percentages and in broad terms as such. We are dealing with those things. So in some instances, what we presented here will reflect the priorities as for the next 3 years. But for each one of them, we have, for example, on NHIU, so we just spoke about March 2010. Because we cannot predict what happens after March 2010 in terms of the adopted policy. It will determine what the annual targets are for the implementation in the 5 years. The Batupile principles. There are two answers to that. One is that we the Department of Health in particular, unlike the Department of Home Affairs, which is actually issuing staff to people, let's put it that way. They issue IDs and so on, and they have to be, I mean, of course, they would have to foreground the Batupile principles. I think for us, they are integrated and intertwined with this issue of patient safety, because we're dealing with human beings and their lives. So critical to that is, of course, the people-first principle. But beyond that, all sorts of other principles that go with that. So, we haven't foregrounded it to say this is how we're going to implement Batupile. But we foreground it in ensuring that we talk about patient safety through handling of all patient cases in a proper manner with accountability for whatever adverse situations arise. And that encompasses the whole range of aspects of the Batupile principles. Nevertheless, on the service delivery side, where you're talking about, for example, pharmacies and all sorts of things like that, then that's where we'd want to see those issues highlighted very much so. Unfortunately, in inverted commas, because again we're presenting a National Department of Health, which is not at the coal face, that issue becomes not less important, but it's not a foregrounded issue for us because we interact with ourselves, with our colleagues in the provinces. And of course, with the public, when the public complains, so some offices will see that as a priority. But from a framework point of view, we would want to think that we're incorporating all those principles in the guidelines that we send to people for treatment of patients. The issue of the operation of clinics is an ongoing saga. We will take it up, the 24-hour issue. It's an ongoing saga, but at one point when the provinces do come to this committee to talk about some of these programs, we may revisit this issue. On the one hand, the problems range from budgetary to human resource to safety issues, because we've emphasized that where we can, let's open 24 hours. They relate to all these issues, and where we can't, let's make sure that transportation is available to take the people to the 5-kilometer thing. So, well, that's just a matter of principle. There are various issues that influence within the provinces, and we would have to talk to them. The 150 that you see here, the only 150 we refer to, not for employment, but for training, was for the CEOs, that in the next MTF period we should have ensured. In fact, we said in the financial year, next financial year, we will actually enroll 150 more CEOs in this program that we're talking about. So the target is for this financial year, which ends in March. So by January, February, when we start, there will be 150 more officers, and more CEOs that are part of that program, which is a master's program, as such. Okay, and then the honourable member asked about the initiation schools and the unnecessary deaths and what we are doing about it. This matter has been a matter that we've been working on for some time, particularly in those provinces that are affected by it. First of all, from the health and education and traditional affairs point of view, we ensured that there's proper legislation to regulate the practice such that people who do this are trained. Secondly, to ensure that they are all linked to hospitals or to health facilities, so that if there are problems, they are able to refer them very quickly. And where that has actually happened, you've seen less of a problem, if not an elimination of the problem. But there's an ongoing fly-by-night practice in this, and that's where all these problems then emerge. And of course, in that regard, as the health department, we are unable to enforce, because the enforcement must come from the provinces and the traditional affairs people, as well as the police. Where you have this fly-by-night chances, we must actually, I still go back to saying, where there's no consequence, then people take chances. But where there's consequence, they continue taking chances because they are South African human beings who like taking chances anyway. But at least they do that with such precautions that there are less of them taking those chances. So from a health point of view, we have a partnership with all traditional, formalized traditional initiators, where we actually are involved in their training, particularly to look at some of the symptoms that would lead to certain problems, complications. We also, in some instances, in some provinces, insist on some individuals being tested or evaluated first before they go to initiation school because of the potential dangers that they have. So this issue is actually a problem of fly-by-night, of illegal school initiation schools as such, and we're trying to see that working with the traditional leadership, that we eliminate this phenomenon in those provinces. Now, with regard to underfunding of tertiary services, can I specifically ask Dr. Chetty to deal with that issue? Not simply because of underfunding, which I will deal with, but just tertiary services in general. How will the budgetary constraints affect the delivery of medicines? As I said, we are already sitting now and we are saying in some of these provinces, if certain things don't happen, by September, October, we will have a problem in delivery of services, not just medicine, because of the budget constraints. So we are working very hard to deal with those challenges so that the provinces don't have that problem. We can already foresee it. As the CFO says, because of the accruals, what was in this current budget was paying for those accruals. So already we have a deficit. They're already operating on a deficit. There's already a problem in some provinces relating to their over expenditure, which was the first cut in this current financial year. And so there are implications of that. So if there will be implications if we are not able to find a solution, and we are working on it. H1N1 advocacy, I think there's a lot of it at the moment. We had started when we were at phase 4 and 5, focusing on those potential areas of possibility for H1N1, the airports, the ports of entry, etc., etc., because we hadn't reached a point where we would have a community phenomenon, but we have already been identifying with the community some of the just basic basic behavior with regard to flu, cough ethics, and all those things that you've been hearing about. To say when you cough on your Dr. Chetty doesn't like this one, cough on your shoulder or something like that, on your sleeve, and you know. But those things have been there quietly and are now being lifted because of the level now of the pandemic, which is level 6. But we still haven't reached a point where South Africa has a kind of community-based pandemic in that regard. We've been able to contain it. It still comes from outside. You know, whenever you have these kinds of issues, you are balancing between creating unnecessary panic and informing the people, the public very well. And that's the balancing act we're trying to do. Because if you think now how many people have flu and flu-like symptoms, even in this house, the minute we say H1N1, the flu symptoms are like the normal flu, everybody will say, hey, let me go and check very quickly, and we'll have a problem. But at the same time, we must get them to go and check. But if you can isolate some of the cases, if somebody hasn't been in contact with anybody who has been in those affected areas, and somebody is not necessarily exposed to those possibilities, the likelihood of them having H1N1 is actually a bit remote. So I'm saying, yes, the community advocacy is actually coming up now. Reopening of schools, where and when. What I was saying was they have been reopened in all provinces where those could be reopened. The second phase, well, where there are some that are still to be reopened, there are one or two. I think there's one in Mpumalanga or something like that. But all of them are going to be reopened in the second sense that I was talking about. In other words, once you have reviewed what are the needs of the country for training, what form of nursing training should we have in the country, in the college sector, and where do we locate those colleges? They will be located in all provinces. And at the moment, I can't say there will be 5 in the Western Cape, 4 in... That would depend on the analysis that we come with. The first phase is for us to do an audit, and that's what we're doing. But where there were colleges that were closed and are supposed to be opened, they will be opened. And I'm saying in most cases, those that were not integrated into higher education institutions are the ones that have already been opened. The standalone colleges If they are standalone, and then the province is working on putting the budget, the necessary budgetary input to actually open those colleges. The honourable member will follow up later once we finish this. With regard to the district, I suppose what we mean here is those district surgeons and so on, and whether they are actually doing their job or they are just rejecting. We've had horror stories in some instances. We've had stories where the doctor will look at a person and say, "You are not sick, you are not sick, you are not sick, you are not sick, go home." And then you look sick, come in, and then they pack their bags and go. We've had those horror stories from members of parliament here. And we've had other horror stories. And I suppose that's why you're asking the question, because in some instances, these doctors have, as a result, not helped people who deserve to get grants because of their disability, not being able to get those grants. We are trying to actually ensure that the provinces do the supervision that we're talking about. It's this supervision that I talked about earlier on, which will help us identify where there are problems of that nature, to ensure that people actually follow the clinical guidelines, but also they do the proper examination of patients. But where these cases are there, and we know that this is the practice of a certain district surgeon, and these people live in our communities and we know them. It becomes urban legend that also, and so we don't go to them, they just look at you. If it happens, and I'm sure the role of MPs here would be very, very important, let's get the provincial authorities to go and actually check what is happening. Why is that doctor doing that? And remove him if he's actually, because it's unethical behavior to just guess that the patient is sick or not sick. That's guesswork. But many of these instances are not reported and dealt with. I agree. Well, we must deal with this issue of the patients lying on the floor of hospitals and dirty hospitals. And on the dirty side, we are mobilizing the community to assist us to clean the hospital. Let's have a clean the hospitals campaign. Now for those that have a labor perspective, that's casualization or privatization or commutization of work or whatever it is. But in some instances, we just have, without doing away with the need for people to be employed to do that, let's start from the premise that the hospital is clean, but you must employ the following five people to keep it clean. Rather than say it's dirty and then leave it like that and say employ those people to clean it. I mean, if I'm reminded of a situation when I was still at the University of Zululand. We used to have an old man there who was working as a cleaner, picking up all kinds of rubbish. You see, he would be very angry if you didn't litter, you know, or if you found a paper and you picked it up. He would say, no, because now, you know, you must leave that one for tomorrow so that I can come and pick it up tomorrow. And so I think these tendencies of such job creation are detrimental to us. So I think the dirty hospitals issue, we don't want to rely on communities to go and clean hospitals inside. But I think sometimes the community must, in partnership with us, get that hospital grass cut and so on and so on. But then say, why is it that we're not employing people to clean that hospital and keep it clean? So those two things should go together. And I think it's a partnership issue. We're going to deal with it. And the patients lying on the floors, we're focusing on those issues. Let's hope that by the end of the processes we're embarking on, which is immediate, we won't see those cases where people seem to be abandoned on the floor. There may be other reasons why they're lying on the floor, but they seem to be abandoned on the floor. And that's something that we must deal with. Every budget is contextually valid in the sense that the depending on what context you are working with. If it's a needs-based budget, then the current budget in the context of needs is not very valid. But if it's if it is also related to the availability of resources, somebody can say, in the context of the available resources, this is a contextual budget in that sense. So depending on what context you are using, you could say this is contextual or non-contextual. The current one is both contextual and non-contextual. From a needs point of view, as we say, although a budget will never actually match the needs, even your own home budget will never do that, even for the richest of the rich, their budgets still don't stretch enough for them to be able to do the things they want to do. But you can be able to say that it aspires towards those needs and there is some trend moving towards them. Currently, what we are concerned about is that the trend is seemingly static at the moment. And there I agree, then the context is not responsive to the context. So we're trying to correct that. As I was saying earlier on, that's what we must monitor if we are to prioritize health, and let's see that steep towards the right. The issue, I think I've dealt with the issue of the government hospitals competing pound per pound, and I'm saying the way that will happen is the day we are able to draw on the private resources and to ensure that we're able to spread the load to also those private resources. And you can see that I'm saying there are many methodologies of doing that. One of them is, of course, the model we're talking about of NHI, but there are other models also of sharing resources and so on, such that the burden will then lead to a problem. But let me hasten to say that in some instances, in many instances, clinically, the public sector is actually far ahead. I have a case of a colleague whose medical aid was finished while he was in one hospital, and then they had to dump him to another hospital. And he was talking about the fact that for the amount of money he had paid in the private hospital, he had been seen by two specialists, and he had to pay both of them. Then he came to a public hospital, and he was surprised that almost every week where he was there, there would be six or seven specialists around him discussing his case from different perspectives for the price of minus one. So in other words, the quality of the service he was getting for the price of minus one was far superseded the quality of service he was getting for the price of two. The expensive price of two. So pound for pound, you can see that in that instance, the pound for pound match is quite different. But we agree. Part of the main problem that we have in relation to our public hospitals is yes, the clinical side, but to a lesser extent, more the hotel side, more the care hotel. Site there we have a problem where people don't have linen, they don't have beds, they don't have this and that, whereas others have their private TVs and rooms and so on. That's what they're paying for. But at the end of the day, when it comes to actual treatment, doctors that work in the public sector, if they are there, will give you the best treatment you can get, better than anywhere else in some instances. Well, personally, I think the Treasury is dealing with it. We are assisting them. We have a human resource system that we're trying to put in place. I've answered the question, is there sufficient budget to deal with OSD? Chairperson, I think we've tried, except Dr. Chetty was going to comment on one or two issues.
Okay, I saw you taking your watch off. I thought you were going to assist us. We will allow Dr. Chetty, bear in mind that if you gave us lunch, we would even go further because this is a real education that you are getting.
I thought we were getting lunch from the committee.
Okay. No, we allow Dr. Chetty to.
No, thanks very much, Chairperson. I'll just deal with the issue that the DJ wanted me to discuss was around the underfunding of tertiary services. It's been a major dilemma since about 1998 or 2000. We've been putting in a budget bid every single year to identify what's the gap in the National Tertiary Services Grant as the conditional grant. There have been small increases in that tertiary services grant, but it hasn't been adequate. We subsequently embarked on a process called the Modernization of Tertiary Services Project, which basically looks at a 10-year reconfiguration of tertiary services as well as regional hospitals and what should happen in the provinces in the future, with the idea of building up the tertiary services in the underdeveloped provinces, so that you don't have to refer everyone to the to Gauteng and Western Cape. The cost of that plan was approximately 10 billion rand. Presented to Treasury, they didn't have the money to provide for the MTS project. We've been asked to update that plan, and that will be presented again. The huge dilemma is with the focus on tertiary services and the training of registrars and academics, which is absolutely crucial. But the question also comes up that primary health care is the cornerstone of our health system. Now, if you're just looking at the hospital services, and especially regional and tertiary services, shouldn't you be looking at the strengthening of the primary health care services? So, again, there's a huge problem of the dilemma of balancing within available resources some of the major problem areas. And just the issue around patients on floors, the DG has responded to it. But could we request, I mean, it's the policy is that there should be no patients on floors because, you know, after 1994, when we're all working in hospital services and we know what went on in King Edward Hospital and you walk in over patients, the policy is to not have that, to not have patients on the floors. I mean, it's to such an extent that some of the hospitals now close down if they don't have any beds. And then the ambulances try to transport patients around where there are beds. And it's become a bit of a problem. But if anyone is aware of patients sleeping on floors, we've got a hotline. Any one of our cell phones is readily available, and then we'll clamp down very hard on that kind of activity. Thanks, Chair.
Honourable members and delegation, I'm sorry if maybe there are some of you who are really dying to have follow-ups, but our time is gone. As I said before, we will still interact with the department because we still have a lot to do on the documents themselves. And by so saying, I'm going to say thank you very much for the presentation, well-prepared presentation, and it covers what we actually expected. And tomorrow we'll be together again in the debate, I believe. Yeah. I will say thank you to those who have attended and to the coldness in here. Our apologies, we don't know what is happening, the technicians and so on. Thank you very much. This meeting is adjourned. Thank you.